Off the Ball, GAA.
It all depends on fitness, and it's a lot with the club. You know, Brian Stack is like the master key. He can do a lot of jobs there, and if he's out, you know, there's a lot of fires to put out as well.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Rugby on Off the Ball
with Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Connacht, Leinster, Munster and Ulster Rugby. Never stop competing.
Hello and welcome back to Off the Ball Sunday's very special Nollag na Mban show. I'm Susanna Mullen, and coming up this hour, we're focusing in on all the rugby happening today across the men and women's game. We had Munster in action earlier against Toulon, in the Champions Cup, where in a nail-biting second half, they lost out by 2 points, with the game finishing 27-25 over in France. Connacht were away from home as well in the Challenge Cup, and they will be bitterly disappointed after they threw away a 17-point lead against Montpellier with just over 30 minutes left to play. The French side came back to score 3 tries in 9 minutes to win the game 33-31. Ulster then were meant to face the Cheetahs over in Amsterdam, but it was called off due to freezing weather conditions just about an hour before kickoff. And finally, the Irish women's side, the Clovers, took on Breath and Thunder in Cardiff in round 3 of the Celtic Challenge at midday, which finished 15-12 to the Irish side. If you have any questions, comments or observations across this rugby hour, you can get your WhatsApps into us now at 0879 180 180. That's 0879 180 180. And joining me now in studio to delve into all the action is former Ulster, Leinster and Ireland player and current coach of the Ulster women's team, Grace Davitt. Grace, how are you?
I'm good. It's been a busy weekend watching rugby, so it was a great way to get in out of cold weather.
Yeah, there was loads to cover this weekend. I mean, Leinster were in action yesterday. We won't dwell on it too long, but 25-24 in the end with Harry Byrne clenching that last minute kick. I mean, what a nail biter that was.
Yeah, it was absolute nail biter. It was a brilliant game of rugby. You know, both teams, we know what a big rivalry has become between, Ronan O'Gara's stalwart team and La Rochelle. And it was just nail-biting stuff, and it's what you want to watch as a neutral. And, you know, we've seen a kick be missed previous to that, and then, you know, to actually be able to finish it off in the 82nd minute, it was just brilliant rugby that we probably haven't seen Leinster at their best yet. But the fact that they had some good players back, you know, you had Henshaw back in the centre there, who made a huge difference, and I thought Van der Fleer had a really good game as well. So they left it right to the end, and I'm sure they'll be wiping their brow and very happy that they got the win in the end.
Yeah, definitely. And what a game for the competition as a whole to have two, you know, top teams bringing their best players to the pitch for such an incredible game. And we have much more of that post-match reaction from yesterday with Andy Dunn across our podcast channels on Off the Ball, and so much post-match content from Leo Cullen, Caelan Doris and all the rest on our socials. But today then, Munster were in action earlier against Toulon, 27-25 that finished up. Difficult one for Munster to swallow. What do you make of that game?
Yeah, I think Toulon did what Leinster did to La Rochelle. It was kind of a payback for the French teams, and it was a nail-biting one. At a point, it looked like Toulon had a full control of that game. Munster were able to dig in, got a really good counter-attack try off a loose line-out, and were able to get the ball into Nash's hands, and he spun up the wing, which was brilliant. But, you know, a couple of loose tries in that second half, really out near the edges, was a lovely chip and chase, and you know, Toulon kind of made easy work of that. But I think the ill-discipline in Munster towards the end just really let them down, and we've seen it last week against Ulster as well, where it's the ill-discipline, the penalties allowing teams back in, and towards the end, and even at the end of the first half, we've seen Tadhg Byrne going off when Munster had a 6-point lead, and you thought, right, if they can hold off here in this first half, they'll do really well. But you know, Tadhg Byrne, you know what he's trying to do, but in that 22, he got that yellow card, and Toulon still got that try, and it kind of same creeped in towards the end of that second half, where penalties just allow. Now, some of them will say Carl Dixon did them bad, where it was Tadhg Byrne again. It looked like he was taking the space And they got the 3 points off a penalty after that, and it was after a later penalty, but it just looked like this ill-discipline. And I kind of feel towards the last few minutes of the game, it really looked like, well, Munster should be glad of the losing bonus point, because Toulon really chased for that. Both teams were on 3 tries. Obviously, Munster was still going for their losing bonus point, but Toulon were really chasing for that try bonus. And if they had done that, then Munster would have lost that losing bonus point.
Yeah, they did very well to hang on in those dying minutes to make sure they held on to that bonus point, because it might come in clutch next week when they play Cash. And the pool is really close. All of them were on 5 points going into this game, except for Bath. I think they were on 6. So that point really... might come into play next week in terms of qualification for the round of 16. But you mentioned ill discipline there. I mean, I have here, obviously, both sides got 2 yellow cards. So from that point of view, it's equal. Munster's to Tadhg Byrne, as you said, and then Jack O'Donoghue in the second half. But then on top of that, Munster had 14 penalties to Toulon's 8. And as you said, they were punished for it in the end with the penalty awarded. I think it was actually against Jack O'Donoghue. So Tadhg Byrne went in, but Jack O'Donoghue was pinged for basically not getting out of the way and obstructing with 5 minutes left to play. And then Marius Dumont, obviously, he had a 100% success rate in that game, slotted it over. Do you reckon, I mean, Jack O'Donoghue and Tadhg Byrne, obviously it's not their fault that Munster lost the game, but they are 2 experienced players, 2 yellow cards. Do you think Clayton will be disappointed in his kind of more experienced players giving away those kind of penalties?
Sometimes when it's a rush of blood to the head, I think Nakavel earlier on in the second half, he had a silly one where he went in and went through the ruck and knocked the ball out of the scrum half's hands and Ben White. You can't do that, but... other ones, when you see teams with high penalty rate, you have to look at what pressure the opposition are putting on you. And I think that's probably the crucial thing of this Toulon team. You know, they are French at heart, but the speed of their ruck play in that second half, they kept the ball alive. They were able to get momentum. And what that does then is it puts the opposition, puts Munster under huge pressure to get back, to get on the right side of the referee. And as a team is building momentum, the team... defending is always going to show bad pictures when you're running back and covering ground. So there is a piece of that where you're going, yes, they're experienced players, but they're the workhorses that are busting themselves to get to that ruck. And sometimes you just, a split second of decision or a picture that you paint for the referee, as you say, that one was a little bit harsh towards the end. But that's, to me, that's what those score, that those penalties indicate. Now, if you see a trend in those penalties and you say they're all like, you know, cynical, or, you know, yes, they're under pressure and they're 22 and the only thing they can do is be cynical. But it wasn't that. It was the speed of ruck, the speed of movement. You know, Toulon were going from one side to the other. They were kicking in behind. They had a variety in their attacks, which I think put Munster under huge pressure.
Yeah, I do think they dealt with it very well in that first half. I mean, they were 6-0 up till the very end, and they were actually doing really well to have speed at the breakdown, not allow Toulon to come in and slow them down, and they were controlling the game really well. A lot of that came from Crowley at 10. I thought he had a good game. He was a lot more noticeable in this game than maybe in that Munster-Leinster game on the 27th. He was quite quiet in that game. Do you think he's looking at the likes of Harry Byrne coming in yesterday, nailing a crucial moment? Andy Farrell was in the stands at the Aviva watching on. Do you think Jack Crowley knows there's a bit of pressure there and he wants to put his best foot forward going into the Six Nations?
I think as a rugby player, you're going to go into every game wanting to give your best. You know, maybe it's the Christmas break, maybe he had a nice time, a nice bit of time to switch off his brain and come back in fresh and ready to go. You know, he didn't play that Ulster game, he had a bit of time, so... yeah, there's probably a bit of pressure and seeing that and seeing what oppositions are doing. But as a player, you can't think about that. You have to just think about your own systems. And, you know, with Munster, he was back in with, you know, Casey. He's there at 10 and there's a bit more control, especially with the likes of Tadhg Byrne back in. You have those big ball carriers in the pack. And I think there's probably a bit of confidence when they're in there. Munster's probably biggest thing is when they're not there, and that control when Crowley's not there. JJ Hanrahan, yes, he's in and out, but they just don't seem to have that control as a team to be able to make the right decisions at the right time. But Crowley did well. He did nice little grubbers in behind, tore, you know, was able to see Toulon's wingers coming up flat and put the ball in behind and put them under pressure to challenge at the line out. So I think he did pretty good. But you can only do that when your pack is putting you in the right position.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting now going into, I think the Six Nations squad announcement will be Wednesday week. I mean, what way do you see that going? We've now got kind of three tens fronting it up, trying to kind of battle it out in these Champions Cup games in the lead up to that announcement. We also saw Crowley kind of move to fullback today and JJ Hanrahan came on at 10. Sam Prendergast yesterday moved to fullback with Harry at 10. So there's a lot of kind of moving parts. What way do you see Andy Farrell going for that?
I think Sam Prendergast playing a brilliant game, you know, the way he controls it, even against La Rochelle yesterday, you've seen him like really drawing players to him, bringing the ball right to the line. And it was Skeldon was coming at him, you know, 22 stone of player coming, and he just invited him into him, you know, turned the player in, got the pass away. Skeldon absolutely empties him, but, you know, it gives, puts Leinster backline into these holes, and that's what Sam Prendergast can do. I still think he is number one. Crowley, you know, probably hasn't been on his best form, but had a really good game there. Missed a couple of kicks, which is probably crucial when you see how close the score was towards the end. So we all know kicking's, you know, 95% in your head. So it, he has to be able to nail that, especially in those big games. And the hard thing for Ireland now going into the Six Nations is our first game is against France. You know, that's going to be a huge one. They don't want the same happening what happened last year and France running away. They want to really start the ball rolling and start the Six Nations strong. So they'll have to pick their best team. They'll have to pick the players that are on form and not just, you know, hope that they're going to perform. They'll have to see the likes of Sam Prendergast carry that into Six Nations training camp and bring it forward. Yeah, I think Byrne did well when he came on. He obviously nailed that kick at the end. He had missed the, he had hit the post previous, and huge pressure kick for him. But he came on, kept it cool, and controlled it really well, and you know got the win for Leinster in the end. So to me, even that attitude and being able to do that and lead your team was very good.
Yeah, it'll be interesting as we kind of build into that Six Nations opener in Paris. Ulster then, obviously there's a few names over in Ulster also putting their kind of best foot forward ahead of the Six Nations. But so they were meant to be in action in the Challenge Cup today against the Toyota Cheetahs in Amsterdam, as I said. It was originally moved to behind closed doors on Friday. That announcement was made, due to severe freeze in the Netherlands, forcing a change of venue. But then it was cancelled today an hour before kickoff. Now, it was already quite a disappointing announcement for Ulster fans who were travelling, or who had planned to travel, sorry, on the Friday. I know they're going to be refunded their tickets, but if you've booked flights and everything to Amsterdam, that's certainly a difficult pill to swallow. For the players today, do you think they would have been disappointed?
Yeah, I think they would. You know, you're going in, you're wanting the game. You've just come on the of a good run of beating Connacht. You know, you've beat Munster at home. You're heading over to Cheetahs. It's, you know, Challenge Cup. They had a difficult loss against Cardiff, you know, right down at the wire just before Christmas there. So they would have really wanted to get their teeth into this Challenge Cup and play the Cheetahs. Exciting. You're playing in a different country, you know, seeing what's the environment going to be like there. It's kind of a neutral venue. It's not going to be all Cheetahs, but not really sure what the decision making was for going to Amsterdam. Probably on the surface of it, you know, was a really good idea. And if we didn't have, you know, a real weather warning in Europe, it probably would have been okay. But, you know, I know we can't control the weather, but you look at it and Netherlands historically isn't a rugby nation, so maybe don't have the things in place that you would have in the likes of France, where you have, you know, the pitches are protected, they have maybe underfloor heating, they have covers on. But the fact that they moved it from Amsterdam because they knew it was going to be too cold there, to then move it to
Hertenbosch.
Yes, and then change the time to like midday or 1 o'clock, you know, to try and optimise the time. But I think by the sounds of it, by the time the players literally came out for warm up and were starting their warm up and they were like, this pitch is rock hard, there's no way this game is going to go ahead. So I probably think the disappointing thing was, why is it left so late? Was that they had tried every opportunity, they had moved, they'd changed time, and they're like, well, the only other option if this doesn't work is it's cancelled anyway. So yes, that's hugely disappointment for fans, but it's maybe the only option that they had for the referee. And you know, you see them saying there, it's the players' welfare, that's what they're thinking of. So it would have been, you know, ridiculous to play a game like that. I've played on a couple of dubious pitches in my time where we maybe started and it was okay, and by the time we finished you were getting like ice burns on your legs from falling, dislocated shoulders from landing on hard ground. So definitely the right call, but you know, questions will be asked as to, one, why is it there, and two, you know, should we have had a better contingency for that weather?
No, exactly. I mean, absolutely the right decision in the end. But you think for the players to be out on the pitch about to warm up and for them the decision only to be made, surely someone could have checked the pitches a couple of hours before. So that'll be interesting kind of as we hear more about that in the wake of it. In terms of, though, as I was saying, you know, Ulster players are trying to put their hands up, and they are putting their hands up for a potential Six Nations involvement in a couple of weeks' time. Missing a game like this, is that going to be difficult as well? We had the likes of, you know, Zach Ward was meant to start today, Jude Postlethwaite in the centre. They'll all be, you know, trying to impress with these games. Is it difficult for them now that they have one less?
Yeah, it'll be difficult in the fact that they're playing the Challenge Cup anyway and they're not playing in the Champions Cup. But yes, every game, every opportunity you have to get out there and play and show your hand is huge. And for the likes of Postlethwaite, he's such a stalwart, amazing 12. He, you know, with Stuart McCluskey when he was injured for Ulster, you know, he still brings that physicality, the same sort of player. And Postlethwaite was missing for the Munster game due to a head knock, so he missed that game. I think Carson or one of the other guys was or McCluskey was back in, but he missed it. Postlethwaite wasn't there before Christmas. Sorry, it was a Christmas one in the Cardiff Cup, the Cardiff game, he wasn't there. So he would have been dying to get back out after injury to show himself as a centre, maybe get an opportunity. So that would have been a huge one for him. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about the Ward brothers. You've Bryn, who's in, Augustus has injured. He had a bad ankle injury. So, you know, you see Bryn getting an opportunity in there, and he gives Ulster that amazing go forward ball, and he's so young. And, you know, even an opportunity to get into camp to, like, pick yourself off against the best, see what it's all about, and get opportunities and sink your teeth into that is will be a brilliant opportunity. And the likes of Zach Ward, so all those guys will be disappointed they didn't get to play, and we'll just have to look forward now to the next game and go, who gets picked? They've had a huge amount of games. I think they had 10 weeks in a row, and you know, Richie Murphy had to do a lot of squad rotation and some of it forced with the likes of Heron getting injured. But, you know, there's been a good group of players now getting opportunities, getting game time, and they're probably looking at the amount of players that have got game time, and it's driving that competition within Ulster, where they're now going, well, I missed this game, am I going to get the opportunity next game? Is, you know, that competition, Stu McCluskey and Postlethwaite, who's going to get in? And, you know, you've Stockdale there, Zach Ward, you know, who's available? And it's driving those standards within Ulster.
Yeah, and you can see it in the rugby that they're playing. I mean, it's been one of the most exciting provinces to watch, I'd say, this season. Speaking of Postlethwaite there, I mean, he's 23. When you look at kind of, okay, McCluskey probably going to be called into the Ireland camp again, possibly likely to start, definitely in the 23, I'd say, for that Paris game. He's 33, though, so although he's playing incredible rugby right now, you know, he's on the older side. Bundy Akeith, 35, Gary Ringrose, 30, Robbie Henshaw, 32, so they're all over 30. It feels like at this stage, you know, should Farrell be looking to bring Postlethwaite in, even just to get experience kind of in and around that Ireland camp, see what he's made of, even if it's not to play necessarily in this Six Nations, but looking, you know, forward maybe to next year's World Cup and even after that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, you want to see, one, as an Irish coach, can players step up to the pressures of going into an Irish camp when you're in and around all those amazing players that you've just mentioned? Plus, there's other opportunities. You know, could you play for Ireland A? You know, get in there, get a bit of game time, understand the way they play. What is it that the coaches are looking for? And can they adapt to the different coaching styles? You know, this is the thing when you're playing so many different levels of rugby. So when you're playing for Ulster, then can you adapt to the changes very quickly into a new system or a different system? Now, we're probably very lucky in Ireland that most of the provinces play the same style, and probably Farrell controls that and understands what way he wants his provinces playing, and the players are able to feed into that, which would really help. But yeah, this is what you want. You can't just expect players to come in and get opportunities straight away. Now, we have seen that with the likes of, say, Gus McCarthy getting in and he gets his chance. But like, he was an absolutely amazing under-20s player, you know. So he was in I-line, you know. You see Sam Prendergast came in under-20s straight into Leinster senior squad, straight into Ireland. So there is a couple of gems like that. Others will have to, you know, earn their right, so to speak, and get in and train for the experience first, and then see how they evolve, how they develop, and bring that back to their club, and then see that development in their club, and can they nail down their spot at club week in, week out, and you know, really make the coaches question, you know, well, if he's playing for Ulster every week at 12 when he's not injured, you know, that's, and he's keeping Stuart McCluskey out, or, you know, it's Stockdale's in every week and he's playing amazing at 15. Well, we need to look at him and Hugo Keenan. But definitely those young players, Bryn as well. Zach Ward, do you bring him in as a sevens player? He's a huge physical man, you know, has played at Ireland sevens over the years, and still quite probably naive in his 15s game, and has to develop that as well. But like, what a better opportunity to do it than going into Ireland and learn off the likes of James Lowe and the centres or the wingers that are all there.
Yeah, I wonder, can you see it happening? Can you see a number of them kind of going into an Andy Farrell camp in 2 weeks' time?
Well, the biggest criticism and the hardest thing is for, you know, the likes of Farrell is, you know, Six Nations is a business, and it's a money making where they have to win or finish high up to make sure that they keep the cash flow coming for the next year. The problem is you also have a World Cup in 2 years. So if you don't keep blooding new players, you're going to be, you know, not have that development, or when the World Cup finishes, suddenly you have a huge drop off in players and you're left having to rebuild over again. So I think he will have to start looking at building the squad up and picking his best 50 players, like we've seen a few years ago where, you know, they had the Ireland A's and then obviously we've seen them travelling and doing a tour as well. So he will be, he probably is always looking at that top 50 players, but maybe now seeing the latest form and seeing the likes of Connacht maybe haven't been performing, and Munster not so much, but Ulster now have been performing, that he has to start bringing in a couple of different faces. And then what that does is it drives going, right, well, if I play really well, actually I do get an opportunity to get into Ireland. You look at Nathan Doak, you know, he with Cooney gone from Ulster, Nathan Doak is now that first choice nine. Like, does he get an opportunity now? He's developed his game, he's a lot quicker now with the ball, he's got a great kick, he's got place kicking. You know, is he another one that gets an opportunity to go in? You know, we see Jack Murphy's still quite young, obviously a great under-20s player, but still cutting his teeth at provincial level, and I think that's probably the right call for him. But it'll be an interesting one to see, because it is hard. There's such a great, amazing players, and if everyone's fit, brilliant. But like, we see the likes of Leinster yesterday, so many props out injured, and then next thing you know, they're right down to the bare bones of who they have available. So that's what you want to make sure that you have your depth chart called right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, all will be revealed Wednesday week when Farrell announces that Ireland squad. So I think that's on the 21st of January. And he'll be announcing the XV squad that day as well. So we'll see kind of who makes it into what group. We're going to take a quick break here, but don't go anywhere, because after the break, Grace and I will be joined by last year's World Rugby Hall of Fame inductee and record cap holder for Ireland, Lynn Cantwell, for a look at the women's side of the game. Rugby is on Off the Ball here with Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Connacht, Ulster, Leinster and Munster Rugby. Never stop competing. We'll be right back. Alrighty, welcome back to Off the Ball Sunday's Nollag Na Mban show. Before the break, we were chatting to Grace Davitt about all the Champions and Challenge Cup action this weekend. And now we turn our attention to the women's game. And I'm delighted to say that we are joined in studio by Lynn Campwell, Ireland's most capped player of all time, still, almost a decade after her retirement, and inducted into the World Rugby Hall of Fame last year for an outstanding contribution to the game of rugby. Lynn, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Yeah? Happy to be in?
Yeah, definitely. No, lovely. And I've been following your show for a while, and I was speaking to the girls outside too. I absolutely adore what you're doing. I think the representation from a female point of view and women's sport and other is just really, really strong. And it's great. It's great to talk. So I was excited to come in and have a chat.
Well, thank you. We're absolutely delighted to have you here. I have to start by asking you about being inducted into the World Rugby Hall of Fame. I mean, how did that feel? Did it come as a surprise?
Yeah, it was definitely left field.
I've seen that video.
I know, exactly. You can take the girl out of Dublin, but you can't take Dublin out of the girl. No, it was. It came completely out of left field. I don't think any of us do what we do for those type of things. But and I think we've all probably walked a funny path in women's sport over the last 10 years. I think now, like, I'm 44 and I probably see where we are in the whole cycle of women's sport. And when you go through what you've gone through in women's sport through our eras, you don't know where in the cycle you are, you know. And I think now you realise that it's quite young. Women's sport, it shouldn't be young, you know what I mean? Like, there was women in the world obviously wanting to play sport and every type of sport for decades and centuries. But women's sport is quite young, and therefore what you're going through at that time, you're just trying to battle through because you know the potential for women's bodies and women's team sports and all of that stuff. And we always have individual sports to compare to. So you're always looking at that kind of barometer of, like, it's possible, whereas team sports tend to reflect society a little bit closer and are a little bit slower to change for all the reasons that we know and I'm sure we'll talk about. So I think when you kind of zoom out and you get an accolade like that, it's probably just a lovely reflection of the work that's gone in. It doesn't mean that there's not so much work still to be done, but it was a nice mention. It was a nice induction, and I think in particular for me, I really connect with the global calendar and the global game, and therefore the time that I spent in South Africa with the Springbok women was very special. And I think the induction probably reflected that as well as our story from an Irish point of view, which was lovely.
Yeah, and I can imagine. I mean, I read that the kind of ceremony for it was on the eve just before the World Cup, the Women's Rugby World Cup final. For you, I mean, what were the emotions like kind of reflecting on your career as you went into that, but then looking at, you know, what was about to happen the next day, a record-breaking crowd, 81,000 in Twickenham, and kind of looking at where you had come from and then where the game is now?
Yeah, look, it was so special. And I think I was actually speaking to Sue Day, we call her Daisy, who was one of the originators of the vision for England hosting the World Cup and the vision of Project 80, which was them selling out Twickenham, you know. And she is actually now the head of the Women's FA. And we were talking about it actually only this week. The World Cup, the Women's World Cup, the Women's Rugby World Cup was just full with so much joy and celebration. For people who were part of rugby and not part of rugby, and why it was so full of so much joy and celebration for people who've been part of rugby is that, for, you know, there's 10 World Cups, you know, we've been through 8 of them, I think, Grace, probably 7 of them, and they've always been hard for various reasons. And therefore, to get to a World Cup where you're actually living through the joy of what's possible for women on field, what's possible for women off field, and the reach and spread through all of the media and all of the wonderful work that was done to spread it wide and far. And the reason why part of the reasons why we want to do it is we want more girls to see rugby and maybe want to play it. And I don't care if girls see rugby and want to play rugby. Once they see rugby and know they want to play sport and sports plays for them, then, you know, that just still makes me happy. And then the separate piece was just joy and happiness for people who were just being part of a brilliant women's sport event, whether they knew the game of rugby or not. I think what we heard loud and clear is that fans, men and women, were going to those games and coming away just buzzing with just happiness because it was great sport. It was so much fun in the fan zones. Yeah. There was just really clear, the standards of the whole tournament were so high level, which is absolutely what women deserve, but it's also a sign of the kind of professionalisation and the commercialisation of the game, and that people really want to be part of the women's rugby story, and commercial sponsors do, and broadcasters and so on. So I think it was a really big turning point. Really, really happy.
And it was so good because obviously you went through that, you know, before the World Cup final, but then we all went to the World Cup. A load of us ex-Irish players went to the World Cup.
I remember that well.
And we met up after. Do you remember? We all caught up in the fan zone. And like for me, like it was emotional. Like it was emotional from going through three World Cups as a player to then, you know, being part of a home World Cup in 2017 to not qualifying for World Cup. So to be there for such a huge, momentous occasion right on our doorstep. And then, you know, reflecting back and seeing all your best mates from what doesn't seem like a decade ago, but, you know, it was amazing. And then for us to actually, you know, celebrate with you and you know, with you reaching that accolade was just unbelievable for world rugby, you know, such a little country of Ireland, you know, for little Lynn Cantwell, you know, for for all you've done, not only as a rugby player, but more so, you know, your advocacy outside of that and what you do and drive as a professional level is unbelievable. So I think after that, it is that roundness of the players on the pitch, the supporters, but also, you know, the old gals looking back and going, wow, look where we're at now. This is amazing. Like,
yeah, it was so special. I was lucky enough to be over there reporting on the World Cup for all the Ireland games. And I was chatting to, I tried to get out and about amongst the fans kind of before every game and talk to some of them. And I had a couple of girls, but one sticks out in my brain. And she was just saying, like, look at this. I'm begging my mum to take me back next week. I want to play rugby. I want to play rugby professionally for Ireland. And like, I don't think I'd ever heard anyone say that before, even though I'd come up playing college rugby and in university and stuff. But Ireland always felt so far out of anyone's reach. So to see little girls looking now and thinking that's what I want to do was probably the highlight for me. And I thought it was interesting a lot when you spoke to the players at the World Cup. They always reference that green wave and how, yes, they were here to get results and they wanted to do the best they could. But one of their main priorities was kind of inspiring the next generation of rugby players and having people come through. Grace, in Ulster, obviously you've coached a little bit with Ulster women. You weren't there this year, but you would have been kind of around the setup. Do you think you felt that boost of energy trickling down into the provinces, into the clubs, into the kind of players watching the World Cup?
Yeah, 100%. Ulster, has struggled over the last decade as a women's sport. But what I've seen in the last few years is that youth coming through and that underage structure and development. And, you know, when Ireland doesn't get to a World Cup and they're not on world stage, it's difficult. Now, probably the downside of 2021 World Cup was that it was Southern Hemisphere. So the times of the games were quite difficult. They weren't, you know, easy to watch. And obviously when your country's not there, you're not going to watch it as easy or as much. But for a World Cup to be so well promoted, so publicised, so marketed so well, as Lynn has highlighted, you know, for big stadiums, that has to boost the club rugby. And you know, the likes of Ulster, they see, you know, the Sive McGraths or the Brittany Hogans going. You're going, there's Brittany Hogan who played underage rugby, you know, at Ballinahinch and Ulster. And now she's going out playing. Fiona Chute, who plays for Ulster, getting in that line out, you know, nearly beating France at the end. And that trickles down. And when girls, it is that whole see it to be it. But when you see someone and the underage girls are training with the Ulster team, say on a Thursday doing skills sessions, they're like, oh my God, I'm training beside one of these amazing players that is going to a World Cup. And then for that World Cup to have 31,000 spectators for a standalone game with Ireland, New Zealand, like, that is awe-inspiring for me, never mind a young player going, wow, this is something that I can do. And you see that with those players, and especially what I've seen with the younger generation that aren't as battle-hardened, is they have that huge belief now, and they're like, I don't want to go on holidays. I actually want to stay home for the summer to make sure that I make every Ulster training session to go to an Interpro. Dad, can you drive me to Enniskillen? There's a session here. And it's a way of life. It's not just I want to be a professional athlete and a pipe dream. It's like they want to put the commitment in to actually get there. And that's the huge difference that I'm seeing.
And what would they, because obviously the Interpros fell just before the World Cup this year. So they would have been missing a lot of their kind of star players, but then obviously got to watch them in something as big as the World Cup. What would those girls have kind of been aiming to do with that Interpro? Is it, you know, it's probably a bit late to get in Scott Beaman's kind of consciousness, but, you know, they get to come in, play rugby, train in a professional environment. Is that kind of the big benefits they're taking out of that?
Yeah, like for me, you know, for years, you know, there was a lot of criticism on the development of Irish women's rugby, and now we see the likes of the Celtic Challenge coming into play. And what that does is it's kind of leaning, Lynn will probably elaborate more, leaning into that professional era of club rugby. So what we see now, for people that don't follow women's rugby as much, you have your club rugby, your AIL, as you do in the men's. You have your provincial rugby, which is a bit different to the men's. And then you have your Celtic Challenge, which will hopefully, you know, amalgamate those provincials to a Celtic Challenge. But for me, Celtic Challenge will maybe lead to you getting more seen from the Irish setup and from Scott Beaman and getting involved there, and who's getting opportunities at game time at Celtic Challenge. Interprovincial, not so much, just the way the calendar falls now. But what that does is that gives you an opportunity to play a bit against the best of the rest. Obviously, World Cup year is a lot different, but in a normal year, you would have your international players maybe involved in those provincial teams, and you can set yourself up against those. But the idea would be to be the standout players for provincial, say the likes of Niamh Marley, you know, plays interpros for Ulster. And now this year, this December, is getting into the Celtic Challenge, getting to show her skills in 10 games, which is a lot more than just your 5 games for Interpros. You're getting that consistency, you're getting that consistent training, that consistent S&C over a longer period of time, for that then to be the stepping stone into Ireland. Unless you're an absolutely standout, world-class Bavian Parsons, but in the main theme, that would be the pathway that I would see. But Lynn, you probably elaborate more on that and what you see.
Yeah, you, Lynn, you're obviously working with the IRFU almost a year now to the day, I'd say, as head of women's strategy for Irish rugby. Does that, I know you work a lot in the kind of grassroots participation, but does it cover the provinces, the Celtic Challenge, all of those things as well?
Yeah, so it's taken a good while to get my head around understanding the full system of an Irish women's rugby point of view. And like the role of head of women's strategy is to try and collectively bring the whole game together. So performance, domestic rugby, commercial comms, leadership and governance around it. And to elevate the priority of the game across every platform and stakeholder across Irish rugby, i.e. within the union, within the provinces, within the clubs, etc. And obviously that type of bigger, longer term plan is a complete system build, which is going to take time. And what's going to enable that is regular multi-annual commitment and strategic commitment, and it being really ambitious, as well as the funding to support that growth. Because Irish women's rugby is 33 years old, and whilst over the last couple of years there has been a significant injection in funding, and what it has targeted is the performance game, and we're seeing the effects of that through what Ireland produced in this World Cup in the last two seasons, and the creation of the Celtic Challenge, which ultimately is elite. It's an elite domestic competition, technically the equivalent of the PWR over in England or the WSL's versions of those. And I'll go into what that's trying to do in a second. But when we talk about the whole system build, what, like, part of my role is to look objectively and say, okay, well, where is the whole system? What opportunities are there for every under 14 girl in every club across the whole of the country, and understand, does she have an under 16s team, or does she have an under 18s team? Does she have a coach? Does she have a team? How many? And that's just a domestic game. But the reason why the domestic game is really important in this whole system is that at some, we have to build the system for it to be sustainable. We are obviously, and this is women's sport across the whole world, we obviously get funding, you prioritise a certain area and you plug holes, but the men's game is 150 years old and the system is built, and therefore you prioritise what is going to be the most effective to make you internationally competitive, whereas the women's game is still not fully built. 14% of all of the clubs across the country that have a women's section have a full pathway. In other words, a girl that goes in at 8 can play all the way up to she's 18. That's 14%, yeah, you know.
It's nothing.
The goal is by 2028 for the 340, but that's still 40. You know, the goal has to be 100%. And that's only 163 clubs across the world or across the country. And there's 217. Not to say that every club in the country needs to have a women and girls section. But one of the things we found is the clubs that have women and girls sections have actually a faster pace of growth of their men's section compared to the clubs that don't have any form of women and girls in their club. They have a slower pace of growth in their men's section. And the reason why that's really significant is, like, our principle is women's rugby makes rugby better. As in, if you have a club that has got a thriving women's section, although, don't get me wrong, we know that that takes more resources. We know that that takes lots more volunteers. We know that that means that the club at a leadership level have to really remodel to be able to want to represent women and girls and men and boys equally. But the effect of your club experience for your players, your coaches, your volunteers, your people just in your communities is better. It's a more progressive sport, and that's what modern day kids and all of us want. So that's a huge piece of work. Then when we talk about the pathway, we talk about opportunities. You know, we have to always understand that there's women and girls playing and men and boys playing sport socially and recreationally and then competitive. And we need to give opportunities for just kids to be able to just play sport, you know, and whether that's touch rugby, tag rugby, and just enjoy your club or your school or your university because you just like playing the game. And then for those who want to be aspirational or can, we have to be able to give opportunities 16s, 18s, 20s to funnel through all the way to national teams. So there's so much there to be built. And like Grace has spoken about the competition options. I think the thing we all know about women's sport is we're trying to design it with women and girls in mind. And we know that that may look different to the men's game. And we have this just magnetic field of the men's game that we always just want to say, OK, let's just recreate that. And while we do in lots of ways, because infrastructure is infrastructure, you know what I mean? You have to be able to go from a 14s to a 16s. There's not really revolutionary ways that you can do that. But we know the environment for women and girls might look different. We know the physiological needs for girls through their life cycle, their reproductive life cycle, whereby they're going through, you know, periods and learning about that as teenagers, the reproductive life cycle as in your 20s and 30s and 40s when you may or may not have kids and then come out the other side in menopause. And the reason why I'm saying that is I think we have to become more comfortable with talking about what are the differences to men and women, and then our sports can cater for that. So Grace has spoken about different competitions. They will evolve, and we'd hope that they will evolve, because with more ambition and funding, we have to be able to connect all the dots and understand how they do evolve. The Celtic Challenge is there currently, and fundamentally what that does is any elite domestic competition or programme is trying to give girls pretty much 11 months of the year access to daily training environments, coaches, sports science and medicine in order for them to get bigger, faster and stronger, right? And the programmes, whether that's Celtic Challenge or whether that's your provinces or whether that's other franchises or other models, they all have to be explored. But the principle of girls having an opportunity to be in a daily training environment for all year round, multi-annually, is what makes her big, faster, strong in 3, 4, 5 years' time. And the Celtic Challenge has started that. What we absolutely know is we're a small country internationally and we need access to the maximum amount of talent across the country. But to Grace's earlier point as well, we also know role models are really important. And if you have role models more closer to home, as opposed to this teams that are less accessible, then it will inspire more girls in your communities to want to play the game, see the game. And whether that's just playing for Munster or Ulster, and that's your pinnacle, then it matters that Brittany Hogan is from Ulster, and it matters in her club, and more girls will want to play and see it and coach and so on because of that. And without those regional role models, we won't have that traction. So building out the regional game is going to be really, really significant over the next 4 or 5 years.
I presume, is it too early to tell kind of whether the World Cup has had an impact on those kind of participation levels at the grassroots level of the game?
Yeah, look, there was an increase in registrations this year by 12% at the domestic game compared to last year, which is good. We don't know, is that related to the World Cup or whether that's just natural growth. I think our big big, really important topic. And this is women's sport all over. There was a recent report that came out from UK Sport actually just last week when it spoke about they've been tracking, they do a study called the Dream Gap. And the Dream Gap is a piece of work that's done with all girls across the UK, whereby they're asking them questions around their ability to dream, i.e., you know, how do they genuinely see themselves as an international athlete or a representative athlete? And largely, there's been a correlation between visibility and the Dream Gap over the last couple of years, whereby each year, as more visibility for women and girls sport, generally, it seems to correlate that girls dream more the more they see girls, and that's good. And we know broadcast and visibility is really, really important. But what they noticed, even after the year of 2025, where in the UK they had the Euros and the Lionesses winning, and they had the Red Roses winning, that dream perception, that those dream stats are actually dropping, which is bonkers, which means, and the big, the real big concern, and we all know this, that it's not, visibility is so massive and it's so, so important. A role model is really important. The opportunities for all the things we said are so, so important. But if a girl is in the domestic game or a pathway, and if when she goes back to training, and if she knows her club really doesn't cater for her, it really doesn't go, not even the extra mile, but my...
She's not valued.
She's not valued, or there's no sanitary bins in the toilet, or if my gear doesn't fit, or I don't have a coach, or we don't get a bus to go and play in that game, or we only have four games a year. You know what I mean? This is reality for parts of pathway, and this is all sports, not just rugby. Then she's going to drop out. So the environment, we can't, there's no silver bullet. We have to build the whole thing. And the other one quick thing I will say before I finish is what it's also indicating, which is good, and which is actually good, I think, is that because girls and teenagers are more aware of the narrative, now if they have a bad experience, they actually know why. Whereas before they would have just dropped out or maybe stayed in and they wouldn't know why. Whereas now they know that's because...
Or they would have just said, that's the way it is and I just plow on because that's just the way it is. Whereas now they're like, no, I deserve better than
that. Exactly. Or I know that I'm not getting that experience and I know that's because I'm not being treated as equally as a boy, or the metrics that they use is girls perceive that, you know, the coaches or the club don't think they're good enough, or they don't think that they should be there, you know, and girls are feeling this and then saying, oh God, like that's just confidence and then I'm just not going to come back.
Yeah,
that's the environment. And that's why our environment, like the holistic approach and the comprehensive approach and our role models and our leadership and our behaviours and how we coach and how we speak to girls and how we develop and the opportunities are really important. So there's kind of a bit of a thing, like it's no silver bullet. Obviously the visibility is so, so massive, but we're actually shifting into an era now whereby girls know more, and when they experience things that are not cool, they know now.
And I wonder, touch on something that you mentioned earlier, Lynn. You said about, you know, the progressive clubs are the ones, you know, the ones that have the women's side become, are the real, you know, the whole club as a whole is really good. And I wonder, is it that progressive approach, whereas not only because of the people and the environment as a whole, not just from the women's side, but the men's side, is actually what develops and grows that club to be actually a really good club, not just a women's club.
Yeah.
You know, because you kind of know progressive mindset, what can we do to improve, and like everybody as a whole is valued within that club. So it'd be interesting to see, because of that, you know, thought process, is that what makes the difference?
Yeah, definitely. And there's loads of pieces in that, like, you know, Old Belvedere are really a good example of a club that have worked really hard to build up their women's section over the last couple of years. And like I visited there a couple of months ago, and I just sat down with the chairman because I was just like, tell me, like, what does it take? You know, how do we build these out? How do we, is it, you know, blueprints? Is it case studies? You know, what's the funding behind it and so on? How do we just get more clubs? And there's a lot of work that goes into it. Like the leadership really has to genuinely elevate the priority of the women and girls game so that they're just more teams that they want to be aspirational, as opposed to, you know, the men's section and the women's section, and we treat them differently. But there's also, but he did, and he pointed across, it happened to be the day that the men had got promoted and the women were playing afterwards, and they were standing up on the balcony, and it was in May and everybody was having beers, and it was the night, you know, the days that, you were
for.
Where you?
Yeah.
And he literally pointed across to his membership and he said, you know what, Lynn? He said, that membership wouldn't be here if we didn't have this women's section. And what he was pointing to was young men.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't that they fancied the girls, don't get me wrong, or maybe they did. The point was that they were progressive young men that saw a progressive club by having equal opportunity for women and men. Like,
yeah.
I believe that's relevant, and he did too, and he is the, you know, he was the lead of it. So, and there's another great examples. Wicklow are a great example, community clubs, but whereby it's all about the community as opposed to
Sections
else. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to dive into all the kind of upcoming Six Nations stuff as well, but we'll just have to have you both back on because it was so interesting. But that is all we have time for this Sunday on the rugby side of things, on the Off the Ball Nollag Na Mon special. Grace Lynn, thank you so much for taking the time to come in. It was really, really interesting.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Connacht, Leinster, Munster and Ulster Rugby. Never stop competing.